Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Extreme cold weather advisory in effect this morning.
You're a contractor. You have a contract.
All right, guys, come on. Let's do this.
A little snow and ice isn't stopping you. Not today, not any day. Shouldn't your flashing tape be working through it all, too? Only Frog Tape Pro Grade Flashing Tapes, high performance acrylic adhesive, sticks, re-sticks, and stays stuck, even on the roughest surfaces in rain, snow, heat, and more. So you stay in control when it matters most. Show weather who's boss with Frog Tape Pro Grade Flashing Tape.
Please note that all information and content on UK Health Radio and our blog are provided by the authors, producers, and companies themselves and is only intended as additional information to your general knowledge and does not substitute professional medical advice or treatment. So please do not delay or disregard any medical advice received due to information gathered on the UK Health Radio.
UK Health Radio, real feel-good radio.
Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians, the companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare. All on the world's number one talk health radio.
Hello and welcome to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost. Each week we bring you the best news, views and interviews with the clinicians, CEOs, founders, investors and journalists, and this week pharmacists, who are changing the world of healthcare in the UK and beyond. As regular listeners know, I am a CEO and founder of a health tech venture myself, which is called PocDoc. Our Healthy Heart Check is now the number one diagnostic test on the high street. It delivers the equivalent of the NHS health check in just 9 minutes using your app and one of our test kits. If you'd like to hear more about that or read more, go to pocdoc.co or head to Well or Pharmacy to You or a number of other high street pharmacy retailers where we are available, including Asda as well. So go check that out. Thank you to everyone who's listening live on UK Health Radio. Johan and his team do an incredible job with the station. There are so many great shows on here, so please make sure you check them all out. Thank you if you are listening on demand or listening on any of the podcast channels. It's really incredible to pull the stats every month and see people listening in over 50 countries worldwide. Thousands and thousands of downloads every single month. We're now being streamed over 300,000 times a month, and that's down to you guys listening, and we really, really appreciate it. If you missed last week's show, it was really quite inspirational. So Sean Stafford, who is a two-time bodybuilding world champion, founder of an incredible chain of gyms. He's also the personal trainer to Spencer Matthews and has been helping him with a lot of his world record-breaking work. If you're really interested in understanding how the brain of an elite athlete ticks and how they combine that with starting a business, how they combine that with being an ambassador for men's health, being a great family man, have a listen. It's a really inspiring story. I've known Sean for over 20 years, and it was brilliant to be able to pick up with him. Now, on today's show, I am really excited about today's show partly because at PocDoc, community pharmacy was the first place that we launched, and actually we were embraced by community pharmacy across the UK. And it was a really, when you're building a business, as many people I'm sure will know, finding your people, so to speak, that get what you're doing and give you a chance is an incredibly emotional moment almost. And community pharmacy was that for us. So it's brilliant to be able to do a show dedicated to pharmacy, to community pharmacy, and to dig into a lot of the issues around it. So on the show today, we have one of the most influential and most likable leaders in UK pharmacy, Nick Kay. But why, other than my personal love for pharmacy, why are we talking about pharmacy? Well, pharmacies are the front door of care for millions of people every week in the UK. And actually, the UK government has started over the last few years to proactively shift more care from GP surgeries into pharmacies. So started with things like blood pressure, moved into sore throats, urine infections. There are a number of others, and there are rumors that that may be extended. But at the same time, if anyone's been keeping a track of the news cycle over the last, month to 2 months, there are record closures of community pharmacies across the UK. And so I think it's a really opportune moment to try and dig into all these different issues. And so Nick Kay is the perfect person to do that with us. He's actually been in and out of Number 10 more than the cat recently. And he's managed to fit us in on a very busy day of interviews, in and around the kind of political situation around community pharmacy. He's the chairman of the National Pharmacy Association and a third generation pharmacist. Nick, welcome to the show. How are you?
Yeah, Steve, thank you very much. Thank you for that introduction. Yeah, as a third generation pharmacist, I often say I should have known better. But it's quite right for you to highlight some of those things. And again, we're really looking forward to having a chat over the next hour about what community pharmacy means for people, and hopefully imparting some of the things that still, gets me up at 4 a.m. from Cornwall to come to London to try and fight the cause in Westminster in about an hour and a half's time.
Yeah, oh, so you're in Westminster in an hour and a half.
Yeah, I'm in Portcullis House straight after this.
Oh, nice. Well, look, again, thank you very much for fitting us in.
No
So
problem.
third generation, does that mean that your grandparents, is that what that means?
Yeah. So third generation. So my maternal father, a grandfather, my paternal grandfather, my dad, my uncle, and my brother are all pharmacists. Yeah. So
Wow.
My uncle used to run a company called May and Baker in Australia, making things like names people have heard of, like Benlin, and then came
Okay.
back and opened a chain of pharmacies in and around Devon. And my dad and I ran businesses together in Leeds and in Cornwall. And my brother's the chief pharmacist of one of the largest teaching hospitals in the UK at Southmead near Bristol. So
Wow.
he's my younger brother. He's often in meetings which he gets to chair and boss me around about exciting things like pharmacogenomics and where the world may go.
Okay.
And he can actually tell me to be quiet and I have to listen, which is very frustrating to me.
Yeah, I can imagine. Why do you think pharmacy ran deep in your family?
So I think actually the clue's in the title, and I do say this every so often, that actually it's community pharmacy. The business that we had in Newquay, I'm 49 years old, and one of the ladies who's only just retired held me when I was 2 days old.
Wow.
So if you look at that sort of multi-generational, that true part of the community, that community name is community pharmacy, is absolutely true. And at the NPA, the National Pharmacy Association, we see second, third, fourth generation pharmacy families who have literally seen people cradle to grave. And you are, in a changing world of maybe general practitioners, and do you see the same doctor every time? You hear the government talk about continuity. Quite often, that community pharmacist is the anchor point for healthcare advice, for trust. And it's amazing, actually. People will say to you, "Well, the doctor told me this, but I didn't want to tell them that." And what do you think? So truly
Right.
embedded in the community is amazing. The other thing I would say about community pharmacy, given all the stuff you've said about sort of funding and all that kind of stuff, it's still a really exciting place to be. I mean, I tried 5 years working a little bit in general practice, which was great, but what you find is, you've got a receptionist there to stop you, whereas in a community pharmacy you can literally be grabbed. You are in the hubbub of it. You can see everything that's going on. And if you'd have told me when I'd have qualified in 1998, I'd have been writing prescriptions, seeing people for antibiotics, giving them injections, I'd have told you were complete giving them health checks, I did like your test as well because, you know, it said that my HbA1c was better than one of my 37-year-old colleagues. So, you know, I'm a big
That's
fan
great.
of your
Take
test.
that.
So it's just a really interesting place to be, you know?
And so let's try and unpick all of that. Quick question, more because obviously we've got a bit of a broad church of people listening. So there's no difference when people say community pharmacy to pharmacy. It's not like a particular type, right? That's just a way people refer to it, or.
Yeah, so actually, if you think about it, so my degree actually would have let me either work in a doctor's surgery as a pharmacist, a hospital as a pharmacist, or actually go into pharmaceutical industry, or work in what I would call community pharmacy, or some people might recognise as high street pharmacies. So, you know, whether that be the big names you talked about, Walgreens in the US, or family-owned businesses that the MPA supports. So even though my brother is the head of a hospital pharmacy who specialised in pediatric oncology or cancer drugs in kids, when he started, we actually started with the same degree actually, and then you specialize from there.
Okay, so was it always called community pharmacy, or did that was that like a term that was coined at
Yeah,
some point?
so it kind of went from the chemist shop. Now then,
Right.
lad, go to the chemist shop. And
Right.
from there it turned into community pharmacy really. That's sort of, if you think now about most of our members at the NPA, which is a stat I learned the other day, which I hadn't realized, that 90% of their income comes from the NHS. So if you think about,
Wow.
whereas you think about normally within a business, you know, you've got, you know, you think of maybe a community pharmacy as a retail unit, you know, with makeup and with perfume and with sun cream and with
Yeah.
toilet. Actually, those still exist, obviously, but they are sort of narrowing. And one of the big challenges we've got at the NPA is actually getting people to realize private service initiatives is something that's actually really important. So again, the stuff that you talk about, you know, the startups, the how does that work? How does that fit in? How do we give people the space to understand that resilience is really important in their business? Because they've probably got too much dependence on the NHS at the minute.
So let's just jump straight into that bit. So traditionally, how have pharmacies generated income?
Yeah, so traditionally what happens is you go to the GP, you get a prescription, a little green piece of paper, or in England now it comes electronically. You hand the prescription across the counter, the pharmacy gets paid a cost for the medicine, and a dispensing fee. So you're allowed to make a little bit of profit on the cost of the medicine. UK government like that because you've got 6,000, well, more than that, 10,000 pharmacies trying to buy things cheaper to push the cost of the medicines down, which is why
Okay.
the UK has one of the cheapest costs of meds in Europe,
Right.
in the developed world, and you're allowed to make a bit of money on that, and then you get what they call a professional fee or dispensing fee. And then what happens, which is really exciting, is you then don't get paid for 3 months, so you have to carry all that cash flow.
Is that right? That and that is that, that that's part of the arrangement. You have to,
That's
it's a
part of the
90-day
arrangement.
payment.
And then after that,
Wow.
if the government say actually in England, if we take England, you're allowed to make £800 million across all the pharmacies, across all the medicines. And that's called purchase profit. That's been fixed for about 10 years. And when it started, there were 800 million prescriptions being dispensed. There's now 1.2 to 1.3 billion prescriptions being dispensed, but you're still only allowed to make 800 million. So
Okay.
each prescription is actually worth less.
So hold on. So let's just back up the train for a second. So, because it's a bit of an unusual situation. I've heard about this before
Absolutely.
from various people, but just again, just to break down. So the dispensing fee,
It's
right,
fixed.
is capped.
Yes, the dispensing fee is fixed, £1.27.
Oh, okay, you get that from
But
here.
the profit that you can make is
Right.
capped at 800 million
Okay, for the whole industry.
for the whole industry in England. So if you had one prescription issued, it would be worth 800 million.
Right. Yeah, you can do the maths. But so like was that when they did that, right? Did was it sort of debated at the time that this cap might not be fit for purpose in a few years, or was it just sort of how did that come to pass?
So it's one of those questions. So we had a 5-year contract, which is actually, we haven't got a contract in England for 24, 25. So we're now 50 weeks into 24, 25.
Yeah.
We haven't had an arrangement of what our contract for 24, 25 actually looks like.
Wow.
But the reason that if you imagine the world 5 years ago, people were talking about Brexit and with other
Yeah.
things and cost of living. And so actually at the time they thought negotiating a longer contract was probably more stable because nobody knew
Okay.
what was going on. But you couldn't have envisaged inflation, COVID,
No.
all of those things are coming across there. So I think at the time they thought it was quite sensible, but rapidly, you know, a contract, well, anyone in business would understand a contract which has been running for 6 years with no inflationary increase, with, you know, we're given what we've been through over the last 6 years, no break,
Yeah.
anything. You can't pass on your costs.
Yeah.
Makes it challenging, to say the least.
Yeah, to say the least, because it basically means that you're having to do more for less per unit of work. Is that correct?
You're absolutely right. And if you think again, if you look at the wider NHS contract context, which I'm sure you've talked about here before, and everyone talks about productivity within the NHS, actually, if you look at that as a pure metric with community pharmacy, it's probably one of the only areas where productivity is excelled, because instead of for the same amount of money dispensing 800 million prescriptions, you're dispensing 1.3 million, 1.3 billion
Right.
prescriptions for
And
the same.
like, do you feel like the community pharmacy or pharmacy gets enough credit from people or anyone, either punters or the powers that be or?
So one of the most interesting moments I had, so being the chair of the NPA, I do say is a professional privilege, but sometimes it weighs heavy. I think, one of only two pharmacists that actually got to give evidence at the UK COVID-19
I
inquiry.
saw that. You did a great job.
Thank you. But one of the things which I found was fascinating was that my evidence was played back to the Secretary of State, to Matt Hancock at the time.
Right.
And he said that community pharmacy was often thought about within the NHS as an afterthought.
Right.
I mean, and
Right.
that's so if you've got an ex-Secretary of State, I mean, irrelevant to your political colours,
Yeah.
that's quite hard to hear.
Yeah, especially when it employ, how many people does it employ?
Million. It's the third largest healthcare profession, 1.6 million visits every day to a community pharmacy. The
Wow.
majority of flu vaccinations are delivered from a community pharmacy for London, more
Yeah.
than any setting. In Cornwall, where I tend to practice, over 35% of all COVID vaccines in the pandemic were given. I mean,
Yeah.
it just goes on and
Well,
on.
and also like the blood pressure, the national
Yeah.
hypertension case finding thing. I mean, you're talking about hundreds and hundreds of thousands of blood pressure readings every month across community pharmacy, I suspect.
Yeah, you're right. And actually, as well, is and the boundaries that keep pushing. In Cornwall, again, we were one of the first systems where we can actually refer patients from, well, there's 93 pharmacies in Cornwall, and from now 25, if you think you've got somebody in with a cancer symptoms for most conditions, you can refer them straight to the hospital.
Hey, what, really? Wow.
Yeah, yeah,
That's
yeah.
completely unique. How did that come about?
So that's an NHS trial that's been going on for about 2 years. I think there's about three systems. I think there's Cornwall, Norfolk. I think there's somewhere in Manchester. But
Okay.
actually, we were first out of the box. And actually, when you're building on things like health checks and other things like that, actually catching people is really important. So, in my career, I've probably had, well, yeah, I can say this. Well, over the last sort of 3 years, I've sort of seen three people which I've had to refer at the time to the general practitioner, but now I could have gone straight to the doctor. So somebody who came in with half a tongue,
Okay.
because somebody who couldn't swallow, which is a really food was getting stuck, so esophageal cancer,
Right.
somebody that couldn't get to the GP and been coughing up blood for 3 months.
Wow.
People think, well, pharmacy, will you actually see it? And you won't see a lot, but actually, when you're in the consultation room, maybe you're having a conversation, like you say, with some of your products about general
Yeah.
health stuff, or somebody's coming in for cough mixture all the time,
Yeah.
or whatever it may be. It just shows you that environment of where people want to access healthcare. They
Yeah.
can walk in, they can
Yeah.
go somewhere private, and
Yeah.
people want to access it in a
Well,
pharmacy.
do you know what? That's really interesting. That's an interesting thread because you can always walk through the door of a pharmacy,
Yeah.
right? You can always just walk through and there'll always be someone there. And is it by law you have to have a pharmacist on
You
site the
have
whole
to.
time,
Yeah, you
right?
have to have a pharmacist signed in for it to legal things. And there was a great statistic before some of these cuts came in, but it was 8 minutes from door to clinician.
Yeah.
It's now slightly longer. I think it's about 15, 16, but on average, from walking through the door, queuing to wait, to being in the consultation room, I think on average it was 8 minutes. I think it's about 15, 16 minutes now,
Yeah.
even with all those efficiency gains and stuff that's.
And I mean I've been in doing Poc Doc and I genuinely mean that we have so much love and gratitude for colleagues in community pharmacy across the country. But I mean I've been in so many community pharmacies in all kinds of different places. And you're waiting to either see somebody to talk about the product or you're waiting to see someone that's using it and talk to them about the account and how it's going or whatever. And you just hear people going up to the counter with the widest range of issues
I
from
can't tell you all of them,
across
Steve.
just yeah, there's so many things, and it just seems like I don't know, it just seems a bit undervalued potentially, like that connection and that engagement.
Yeah, absolutely. And the connection is absolutely true. You know, the things that I've seen from, I've had all sorts of things come in. And again, I think that pharmacy first in England, where you can walk in and get paid for that clinical consultation, is something that's happening. But also, I've been amazed as a prescriber how many people actually will pay for private services. So, I can write any prescription a GP can. So, I think it's a really interesting thread to see about where that blend between NHS income and private service then comes through.
Let's pick up on that after the break, because I know that there's a whole bunch of stuff that's been going on. So let's just, if you could briefly kind of like set the scene, because obviously you've mentioned you're in Westminster quite a bit. If anyone's been following the news cycle, like I said, there's obviously quite a bit. We don't want to talk anything down. I'm a huge fan of community pharmacy. It's awesome. But what is the current situation as you would explain it, and sort of how did we end up here?
Yeah, so current situation, just to explain it, investment in Scotland, a bit in between in Wales, Northern Ireland, a bit like England, and we've basically had a flat funding income stream for 6 years after 4 years previous to that money being taken out. And that's what we're really sort of fighting against, especially when government want us to do more things, take more things like pharmacy first. Somebody described pharmacy to first to me, which is where you see people for different clinicians, the perfect icing on a crumbling cake. And maybe that's the best way to describe the scene before we come back soon.
And so how the pharmacy first, because I'm not sure if many people listening will know the term, but it basically means it's blood pressure, urine infection, sore throat. What are the others it
Yeah,
covers?
so basically there's seven conditions you can just walk straight in for and get a prescription if needed, plus contraception, plus blood pressure.
Right.
So and those things vary from ear infections to skin bites to shingles
And
to
that and the and the provision of those under your current arrangement is supposed to be covered by your profit on the dispensing. Is that
No,
correct?
there's a separate fee for it.
Oh, okay.
There is a separate fee for it. But it yeah, it's
Just
the
doesn't cover.
Well, 645 million was ring fence, but because sometimes you need to be referred from another part of the system, you can't do walk-in with everything. Some
Okay.
people, they don't meet the antibiotics, don't get it. I think only 12% of that income was actually delivered.
Is that right?
Yeah, I think, or less, no, 120 million of 100, no, the math is slightly wrong. But yeah, about 120 million was divided of the 645 million that was ring fence.
What happened to the rest of the
Well, I'm going into Portcullis House for in a minute. I'll tell you
money?
after this. I'll tell you
Yeah, good.
what.
All right,
Not
look,
before
okay,
best.
we'll pick up on this after, but this is really interesting, and I think that this is relevant to everybody listening, but particularly because there's no way that the community pharmacy should be an afterthought, given it sees 1.6 million people every single day. So the changes and the differences and these matter to us all. So I'm looking forward to picking it up in the second part of this week's show with my guest today, Nick Kay, the chairman of the National Pharmacy Association. We'll be right back.
The station that makes you feel good.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Message and data rates may apply. Consult a doctor prior to use.
Wow, you look amazing. What have you been doing?
I'm sure you've heard of Ozempic, Wegovy, and the other GLP-1 medications, right? Well, I found this great company called Zelthy. If you qualify, their providers can prescribe medications like Ozempic and Wegovy and other GLP-1 medications that are 80 to 90% less expensive, all 100% online.
I can get GLP-1 medications for 80 to 90% less and do it all online? No doctor's office or pharmacy?
Yes, Zelthy can provide semaglutide or tirzepatide, the active ingredients in Ozempic and other expensive GLP-1s. But for 80 to 90% less and ship directly to your door.
How do I get started with Zelthy?
Call #250 with the word care to get started today with Zelthy. Get the same active ingredients in Wegovy or Ozempic, but for 80 to 90% less and 100% online. Don't wait. Call #250 with the word care right now for a link to your exclusive offer. Call #250 with the word care. That's #250 with the word care. #250 and care.
Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Good. Hello and welcome back to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my guest this week, Nick Kay, the chairman of the National Pharmacy Association. So Nick, before the break, you sort of laid out that the kind of current situation is that the pharmacy is being asked to do more, deliver more services. Why is that? Why is pharmacy being asked to do more services?
Yeah, and I think that's a great question. I think there's a couple of reasons for that. One is, you know, to be a pharmacist, you have to have 5 years at university. So highly qualified.
I didn't know that. That's a really long time.
Yeah. And then I've done an additional year to be an independent prescriber, so to write prescriptions. Every pharmacist that graduates after 2026 will come out with the ability to write prescriptions anyway. Mm-hmm. And that then absolutely changes the amount of medicines that you could give and access to people. So why? Highly qualified healthcare professional, a really good sort of generalist, a support to wider healthcare systems, and super convenient. You know, if you think about it, you know, most people live 20 minutes walk from a pharmacy. They buck the inverse care law for deprivation. So in the most deprived areas, unlike general practice colleagues. So, you know, in crude terms, we're in the right place. We're accessible. We've got highly qualified people. And, you know, for me as a 49-year-old overweight male dad of five, I probably don't access my healthcare in the right way. However, I may well be in the pharmacy picking up some capital or doing some other stuff. So actually, if you look at some of the things that this government's talking about as far as things like prevention is concerned and care closer to home and all those things, there's just so many boxes that the community pharmacy ticks.
Yeah, I mean, we've with PocDoc and the work that we've been doing with the NHS, the community and community pharmacies is such a key role. I mean, we've seen time and time again the ability that community pharmacy has to find more people who are at risk of developing, in our case, cardiovascular disease is significantly higher. Engagement rates are significantly higher. To your point around health inequality, so, you know, they're present in areas which are otherwise, or the system, if you like, sometimes refers to as hard to reach, but you can reach people if you go in with a community sort of approach and a community model of care.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the other thing as well, I'd say, is there's a huge amount of trust. So the other thing, which is really important, you know, again, especially, you know, if we pick on your amazing kit, you know, we have people who come in who, you know, they want to know, but they may not want it straight away on their medical records, or they may have a conversation about what does it actually mean? How does this affect my insurance? You know, I'm a fisherman, I'm a farmer. What does that actually mean for me in my normal world? And, you know, that not only the information, but also the interpretation of that information is super important. And, you know, I got loads of questions about, you know, vaccine hesitancy around COVID again. You know, that trust point, I think, if you've got a regular community pharmacy, you might be the one regular point of healthcare. It is that trust point, again, is really huge.
And to the point, because it seems the thing I think about community pharmacy, a little bit like you said at the beginning of the show, it's a bit of a world of contradictions at the moment. And what I mean by that is that there's some really incredible groundbreaking stuff happened. Like in Cornwall, for the last 2 years, it turns out in 25 pharmacies, you can actually get referred directly into the hospital for a cancer follow-up. And we've interacted with pharmacists. I've interacted with pharmacists around launching new services. You know, like it's incredible that over the last couple of years, so much has shifted out of general practice into the pharmacy. And if you're a bit of a kind of a back-end data tech nerd like myself, the very fact that you've got back-end systems that can transfer results from pharmacies into GPs sounds simple. It really ain't. That's really amazing. And then also the changes around, like you said, that by 2026, every single qualified pharmacist will be able to write a prescription. Like all of this stuff's really happening. But at the same time, there's these structural concerns around it. So how in your head do you kind of bring all this stuff together into like a cohesive whole?
It's a huge challenge. And, you know, it's one of the things I actually find really hard, you know, about actually, I really enjoy being a community pharmacist. And actually, I see it as such a great place to work and practice. I think there's a couple of things you have to do. You have to take people on a journey of art of possible, and you have to show them what can be done. And somebody, you know, said to me the other day, you know, change is inevitable, but working hard is a must, or progression is a must. Change is inevitable, but working hard is a must, or progression is a must. And I thought that was quite an interesting quote. Who said that? And apparently I did in an article, which I did, which was played back to me. But what you do with it is you actually then actually look at it and go, well, you know, what about private service? You know, what about doing it outside of the NHS? How do you actually show it's done? You know, get yourself a new clinical system which allows you to record data in a different way, you know, write a prescription in the right way. I do think as well that medicine supply is absolutely critical. You know, if there's an
emergency, interesting. Let's talk about this.
Yeah. Medicine supply is absolutely critical, but you're seeing more shortages. You're seeing people dispensing it for less than we actually get paid for it. And, you know, or dispensing at a loss is a term people may have heard in the popular media, which is crazy. So
hold on. Wait, what? So, why would anyone do that?
Well, because it's part of our NHS contract. So we have to supply you with the medicines, even if we don't make the money out of it. So for example, there was one which is a blood thinning medicine. So we get paid, the way in which we get paid from the NHS is something called the drug tariff.
Okay.
The drug tariff price changes, it updates monthly. So at one point, a drug tariff price for a blood thinning medicine, I think was running at about £6, but no one could buy it less than £24-25.
And you, because you buy from the private market or you buy from like a closed
wholesaler? Yeah. So we buy from an independent wholesaler. So if the price goes up, you just goes up. So
hold on a minute. This is blowing my mind. So
it's the best contract ever, Steve.
Yeah. So what you can basically get reimbursed for is capped.
Yes.
From the NHS.
Yes.
But you're still at the mercy of the private market in terms of purchasing that.
100%. And not only
that's brutal.
Yeah, it's brutal. And not only that, as you remember, we said before the break that it was 800 million that was capped on purchase profit.
Yeah.
If somebody does a bit of research and says, actually, we found out on these particular molecules, you made too much money, they'll ask it for you back. But the best thing even with that, though, is they will work it out as an average. So say in Cornwall, drug X, we don't use. But in Devon, in a different part of the UK, drug X is always used. What they'll say is, well, on average, you did 10,000 items. The average pharmacy does this. Therefore, we'll take that money off you, whether you've earned it or not. So it's not a molecule. Yeah.
No way.
So I think I think at one point there was a bit of data which said there was a six-fold difference in the purchasing income that could be earned depending if you were in Birmingham or in, I think, Kent, depending on what the doctors wrote on their prescriptions.
Wait, so how many times... That's bonkers.
Yeah, it's great.
It's absolutely bonkers. that's structurally crackers. That is. It's not a technical term, but so how often does it happen? Because obviously, if someone has a prescription for a thing, you can't not prescribe it, right? That's the law, basically, right? Yeah. So how often does it happen that thing you're underwater on because you're having to purchase it at more than you're getting reimbursed for?
So it's a really interesting question because we probably don't know until afterwards because the way in which the work and all that kind of stuff. And there was a fantastic bit of data a colleague of mine did where they took, I think, the 8,000 individual SKUs that he dispensed in 1 month, and most of them were flat. He had a profit line, and about six items made him most of his profit. And then at the other end, there were about three that lost him, and most of it was flat across the middle. But literally, I think 80% of his profit came from four individual molecules. So if the GP turned those four individual molecules off, he would then be making a loss.
And so how, in that instance, how close is your relationship with GPs around what they actually put on the piece of paper or electronically at this point?
Yeah. So it's a really important question, but actually even GPs don't tend to get a lot of choice with that now. So a lot of these changes are driven by things like what we call in the UK, integrated care boards and medicines optimization teams. And those people that actually say, you know, people may have had prescriptions where their brand of inhaler's been changed or their painkiller's been changed or whatever it may be. So a lot of that is driven from a central efficiency point of view. So even the GPs don't actually have that much say over it. It goes on those repeat medicines. It goes, these are the things on the local formulary that you should use. But I think, although it's really important, I do think as things progress, back to your question about how do you balance all this up, I think clinical service is going to become more and more important as part of our income stream. And at the minute, what we're in is we're in a period of transition where you can't make enough money from clinical services. Medicine supply is still important. But while we're in this flex of transition, how we get there, I think, is going to be really important. But we shouldn't lose medicine supply along the way.
I don't think you can. I mean, I think the whole country would collapse if medicine supply was stopped or somehow impeded at farm. I'm not sure people even really, I mean, I don't really think about it either. It's just an automatic thing. You go to the pharmacy with your prescription.
Yeah.
Imagine if that wasn't the case, what would happen?
No, I mean, and it's crazy. And, you know, you sometimes have central distribution hubs, all that kind of stuff. But, you know, if you need some antibiotics, you know, you're not going to wait for it for 3 days to come by post. You know what I mean? It's one of those things whereby that instant access to medicines, I don't think we realise quite how important that is. You know, there's over 10,000 individual hubs in England that are there ready to give you medicines whenever you need it, which is amazing.
Well, let's talk about the role of online here. because I think that we sort of touched on it a little bit there, and there are some people that talk about same day delivery, and we work with Pharmacy to You, and obviously we're not on the prescription side, but on the, I guess, the digital service side. So like, how has that rise of the online pharmacy changed community pharmacy and what has it left unchanged?
Yeah, so I think a lot of that stuff, you know, let's be really clear, you know, the MPA represents, you know, lots of online pharmacies, you know, and you mentioned Pharmacy to You as the largest in the UK, in England rather. I think what it's done is actually it's absolutely right for some people, you know, and it's certainly made the delivery of repeat prescriptions, you know, regular things accessible for other people. You know, Pharmacy to You is the largest single dispensary in England. We have, you know, you have to be mindful of that.
Is that right? So because it's one entity,
it's the largest single dispensary. Also, if you look at their accounts, they've never made any money apart from when they partnered to deliver COVID vaccines. So, right. You know, they're investor backed and they, you know, they haven't yet turned a profitable income stream. So I think from a business and investor point of view, it's a really interesting model, quite accessible for patients. Could you afford to run it if you weren't investor backed? I'm not sure, but I think those are the things that it's been really positive with. And the other thing which I've been quite surprised is I think online has about an 8-12% market share, maybe a bit more than that, but it's kind of flatlined over the last sort of 4 or 5 years.
Is that right?
Yeah, it hasn't continued. So whereas everyone thought it was going to go, it seems to be almost like the stuff which is, you know, people that have blood pressure medication every month or da-da-da-da-da, you know, a lot of that kind of bulk standardy stuff has kind of gone. But, you know, anyone that's involved with healthcare will know is, you know, you go in for a check and then your prescription's out of sync and you've got one that runs at 2 weeks and one that runs at 3 weeks. And actually, medicine supply is more difficult than other things because one person isn't in charge of the whole thing. So you know, doctors writing a prescription, your prescription journey goes in, receptionist generates it, GP or pharmacist will sign it in the doctor's surgery, then it comes into the pharmacy and then is it in stock? And then, you know, so it's not like I'm on Amazon, you know, one of my kids' bikes is in stock and it's dispatch. It's much more complicated than that. So really, I think online, really important, really, really useful for some people. Been surprised about how, you know, the market sort of share has flattened off over the last couple of years.
Do you think that that's because everyone that wants to use online pharmacy is using online pharmacy by this point, and it's sort of the rest of people aren't really that bothered either way?
Yeah, and I think a lot of that has come to that sort of maturity of market. You know, Pharmacy to You has been around for a long time.
Yeah, really long time.
Yeah. I mean, and it was enabled by electronic prescriptions in England, which came in about a decade ago. So, you know, once now those things have kind of stabilized and matured out, those things happen. And, you know, the other thing as well is, again, the system is under pressure. You know, every 28 days or every 56 days, you know, you're quite often almost an just-in-time moment, aren't you? Your GP don't order it too early, you don't have the medicines waste. So, you know, it's difficult from a logistical point of view to get it in the right place.
I've got a question, which is like, how, and this isn't a setup, by the way, this is a genuine question. Yeah. How there's, as I understand it, there's, depending on the maths, there's sort of like, 8,000 independent pharmacies in the country, give or take. I mean, you obviously know more than I do. And a lot of them have less than 5 shops, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
you know.
So how does a low number, how do small businesses cope with this complexity?
It's really, and again,
running a business is hard anyway. Whatever.
No. So I always say in a community pharmacy, if you're a single-handed owner, it can be a really lonely place. And actually, I know you said, like you say, it's not a setup, but you know, a lot of people describe to me the NPA as 104 years old as a family of families. Do you know what I mean? Because actually, it's people where you connect in. You also look out to local structures. You know, you try and in a competitive world, you know, the person who's running the pharmacy down the street is probably your main competitor. But actually, when you step out of that, actually, they're the only person that knows what you're going through. So and I often say to the independent community pharmacy is business owner, HR, lead clinician, counsellor, you know, and actually, you know, under financial pressure, it's a huge responsibility. It is a way of life, genuinely.
Yeah. And like with all of those pressures, like, because I mean your whole family has done it, and also from what I can tell, that's quite common, you know, it's a family business often, right? So people must like it in some way, shape or form despite all of that.
Absolutely. I mean, and you think, what on earth, which is why I started this by saying I should have known better, really, Steve. Right. Do you know what I mean? But I think a lot of this is actually, you know, the sort of the need we feel to serve the communities we're in may sound a bit contrite, but it's absolutely true. And actually the number of people that you catch who have missed the system, who have fallen through the gaps, you know, you're almost trapped like the community pharmacy or the pharmacist, you know, whether it's maybe a prescription that's been written incorrectly by a colleague, you know, you are backstop. Mm-hmm. You are the last point of catch. And that now is running through into clinical conditions as much as anything else. You know, I saw a lady who came in to talk to me about her sore big toe, and she thought she had an infection, but actually after being in the consultation with her for about 4 or 5 minutes, I realized she was suffering from postnatal depression and she was just reaching out. So those are the things where you just absolutely feel that you are that backstop. And I think that's why people do it. You know,
I can totally understand that. So in an ideal world, given everything that you're working on with the political scene and things like that, what's the wish list, so to speak, at this point?
Yeah, so the wish list is a rebasing of the core contract, make sure that we're not dispensing medicines for a loss, that actually people can concentrate on knowing what the future looks like for them. You can't be 50 weeks into a 52-week year without having any financial year may look like. And actually, some of the belief of the rhetoric about how we hear the words that, you know, we are a crucial part of the healthcare system, so that actually to translate into something that's meaningful. So stabilization, and then, you know, let us pay our parts, clinicians, and not have to worry about whether or not we need to sack Frieda this week, because the core contract is no one knows what it's going to be like from April the 1st.
Doesn't seem unreasonable to me. I also think, having been through it with PocDoc, I think people underestimate, unless you've been in community pharmacies and you spent time there, how difficult it is to just launch any kind of clinical service in a pharmacy because of all of the quite understandable standard operating procedures, safety checks, clinical risk checks, training, you know, all of those things. Like, it's not just like willy-nilly, oh, why don't we just launch weight loss today? I mean, there's a huge amount that goes behind it.
Yeah, I love an SOP. And like you say, as regulated professionals, these are the things where, you know, we do need to have that done and done that to the right standard. But I think that's part of the journey that we take people on. Actually, do you need to be in this NHS, environment all the time? Or actually, weight loss should, you know, as somebody that's launched private weight loss clinics, how should we do that? What's the best way to do that? How do we keep both clinicians and people safe within that journey? I think is a really, really interesting question.
Well, we can pick that up after this, because I know that pharmacists or pharmacy was that I don't quite know who exactly it was, but there was a major intervention recently around the safe prescribing or the safe use of those. So we'll get into that after this last break. We're going to be right back with the last part of today's show with Nick Kay, chairman of the National Pharmacy Association. We'll be right back.
The station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio. The station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to this week's Health Tech Hour, the final part of this week's Health Tech Hour, I should say, with my guest today, Nick Kay, the chairman of the National Pharmacy Association. So Nick, before the break, we picked up on this. I want to dig into this. GLP-1s, weight loss drugs, weight loss management. So yeah. I'm guessing quite a few people listening have probably come into contact or heard about this type of stuff. Many of you may be using it. Friends and family might be using it. I know I have friends and family using the injectables. When did this really hit community pharmacy?
Yeah, so I think this is really interesting, actually. So community pharmacy tends to operate across two places with this sort of space, really. So the medicines themselves have been around for quite a long time, primarily in the use of diabetes. So, you know, they used to be in daily injections and then weekly injections. And then actually what the pharmaceutical manufacturers found out was actually people were losing weight as a side effect and thought, oh, okay, we could market this. Where's this going? So the molecule itself, especially in some of the older ones, the more familiar ones, they've been around for 10, 12 years, you know, so that would be sort of, you know, again, you know, that would be the Ozempics, the Wegovys, and then things like Mounjaro probably around a little bit less than that, maybe 5, 6 years. So pharmacy has been involved with them and the understanding of them clinically for quite a long time. And then from a weight loss point of view, you know, probably the last sort of 18 months to 2 years, Has been where people have kind of really started, and it's really ramped up over the last 12 months. So whether or not that's, you know, whether people have worked on what we call patient group directions. So if you're not a prescriber and somebody fits a certain amount of criteria, you could supply it privately. Or if, like myself, you're an independent prescriber, you can take a clinical consultation and then go from there. I think I've probably prescribed over 200-300 over the last years. So and really, really interesting. But and actually, it's one of the things where I found it really interesting as part of my job running that part of the private service type of the business, because it's been fascinating, actually, because people really do go on a journey. I mean, I've seen people who were on medical cannabis who don't take it anymore because of their pain's gone. I had somebody who was on three oral diabetic medications and an injectable diabetic medication who's now just on one. You know, one person who's lost 6 stone, but in a controlled way over about a year. It's not right for everyone. It's not a panacea. It's not a magic bullet. But I do think it is something that, if it's done right, it's really important. And that's the bit it needs to be done right. So you'll have probably seen, well, people may have seen, you know, there were things like a Channel 4 dispatches program, and there was also...
Yeah, that's what I was going to talk about.
Yeah. So, you know, my colleague, Olivier, the vice chair of the NPA, he was on that. So the NPA had come out a little bit before the dispatches program and said, look, although online is right for some people in this space, you know, there's something about verification of weight, and you were hearing things about people not having done that. So we came out and said, realistically, rather than it being a tick box questionnaire, we think it's probably video consultation or face to face, because actually you can gauge that, you know, in a clinician. You know, I can see you on the screen today, Steve. You know, we can, you know, if you're suddenly, you know, if your BMI is not appropriate, you can pick that up pretty quickly, and then there's ways to verify that.
I mean, particularly because I think it's a 30, is it 30 for some people, 27 for others, but it's a pretty chunky, it's, sorry, wrong term. It's a pretty decent BMI. It's not,
You're absolutely right. So, you know, if it's above 30, no comorbidities, between 27 and 30, you've got some flexibility. Has somebody got another reason why it might be helpful, high blood pressure or something physical with a knee or whatever it may be, you can sort of, as a prescriber, you can sort of, than that. And below 27, it's a no, because it's not safe. So, you know, those types of things about good practice, it's a way, again, I think as somebody who really does want to give the right level of care, you know, my job within those private services is to keep the person safe, make sure that they're okay. And, you know, I've had horror stories where people have come in to me and said, look, I bought three months of medication going up every month in strength, and what does that look like?
Is that because people attenuate to the dosage? Is that why it goes up?
Well, I've had one person for 6 months who didn't go up at all in strength. But there are packages where people just go in, they go click, 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 before the regulations change, and go, I've got 3 months, 2.5, 5, 7.5 going up every month, with no real clinical input into that. So I think really, really helpful medicines, and you know, they really are changing, as you'll have seen, lots of people's world and life, but it needs to be done in the right, safe way. They're not without risk, and people need to understand and explain that risk, or just simple things like explaining how the pens work and how you get rid of the jam, and just that practical stuff, you know.
And like in your estimation, given your experience, what do you think the next 12 to 2 years looks like for that market?
Only growth. Yeah, and the other thing as well is, you know, if you think about, this is probably the last medicine since something like Viagra that's cut across into social consciousness. You know, people understand what blue diamond pill was. People understand what a weight loss injection is. Even if you know nothing about anything else, you'll understand the social context with which those things exist. But, you know, those, what I would call generic tableted medications, the price can tumble and become really cheap. Actually, within these medicines, you know, there's so many patents, they're injectable. There's only so many labs that can make it. You know, there's so many patents involved in the device. This, I don't think, is ever going to be a cheap medicine.
And so do you subscribe to the theory that it's right for some, but how do you address the issue around health inequality around an expensive treatment like this?
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard, actually. So, you know, people have actually asked me, you know, can we pay weekly? You know, I mean, you genuinely get those sorts of questions. What I've been really surprised is how people have prioritized it with their health, even when they've been struggling. And it's quite hard as a clinician. You know, I've been, you know, coming from an NHS background, moving into that private service, it's quite hard to move in that sort of sphere. Mm. you know, the NHS will prescribe it, I think, in England. It will prescribe it, I think, if BMIs for certain conditions or lots of conditions are over sort of 36, 37, whatever it may be. The other thing, I think, as well, as far as an investment is concerned, it's really important. I'm really keen to see what I would call the bounce back data is going to look
like. Yeah, have we seen any yet?
The only thing I've seen is, which is, I haven't seen anything published yet, but I did hear some stuff from some fairly senior colleagues. It's running at about 10%. Which I was remarkably low for.
I thought that sounds really
good. Yeah. And a lot of that is because people are actually retraining. You know, Steve, like I said, I'm 49. You know, my parents' generation and maybe my grandparents' generation was, you know, war generation. You eat your food. You don't get dessert unless you've cleaned your first plate. And then you get the, you know, and it just trains people to go, actually, you don't need to eat that much. This is what you're doing. So part of that retraining journey is really interesting to watch people go through. I mean, as more data comes out, the bounce back might be more. But that,
I mean, if it's really that low, this thing is going nowhere. Absolutely nowhere. I mean, like, that's incredible. If it's 1 in 10, that's pretty phenomenal.
Yeah. I mean, it is. I mean, it's a really, really, but you know, it's really important as well that, you know, when you're doing that, you look at the person as a whole, you know. So it's not just about, you know, you don't want to really, is it a weight loss clinic? You know, we talk, you know, we have a lot of people where we actually don't prescribe the pen for, you know, actually, if you go for diet and da 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 da. And if you can look at a patient as a whole, as pharmacist, you know, you can look at them as a whole and go, actually, this is right for you. Or have you thought about that? You know, it's more than just, you know, ticking in a form and going, here's what we gave you. Do you know what I mean? Doesn't float my boat at all.
I mean, I think that there's obviously, so we actually, in a number of different instances, the POCDOC intervention, we've been used as the trigger to get people into that pathway, both not necessarily just for injectables, but like a broader weight loss pathway that can include injectables, either NHS or private. And it's been really successful. So that sort of, okay, I'm not just overweight, but my cardiovascular health is poor, my heart age is high. Yes. Okay, that's the, and then actually being able to follow that through a digital pathway that we developed after the test to connect them dynamically with that program is really efficient. I think the big question around the prevention space that I've been hearing go around is that we surely can't be lining ourselves up to inject ourselves.
No.
All the time. So there's still we still have to focus on the work of prevention.
Absolutely. And you know what? It is really interesting. I mean, I think one of the most salient comments I've had about any of these products is a lady who came into me who was in her mid-50s, said she battled with her weight since she was a teenager. And she said to me, it's the only thing she didn't feel like she was doing where she felt like she was punishing herself. Now, there's so much in that statement.
There is a lot in that, isn't there?
There is. And actually, exactly as you described, though, what it had done is it actually given her the confidence after nearly sort of 35, 40 years to actually go to the gym, to start swimming, to actually build in all those things that were really important to her that she'd never had the confidence to do. And it's a really
comment
that Stephen, I said, I'm not counting red days, green days, calorie counting. You know, I am not punishing myself. I am choosing not to. And that's huge. But it can only be done as a whole wraparound of care. You know,
it's interesting. Yeah, it's a really interesting area. It'll be fascinating to see how it develops, because you can't take away willpower. I don't think we should be trying to optimize for not needing to try or do different things or focus on being healthy either. But it's a balance. It's a massive balance. And there are loads of people like that lady, I'm sure, out there who, you know, try. I mean, I saw some stuff from some of the feedback that we'd had through some of the programs that we've been involved in. And it's sort of like, you know, I've been trying to go to my GP to get this. Yeah. I've been trying to do this. And, you know, I've been spending 20 years trying to do this and it just hasn't worked. And, you know, actually, this is the first time where something's actually worked. And, you know, so you can't take that away either. You shouldn't.
No, and it was fascinating. You know, I had a husband and wife couple in, and the lady described it to me as, you know, I now think like him, which is really interesting. And he had never battled with his weight, but he didn't feel the need to go and grab, you know, when they filled up the car to go and buy a pack of crisps and a thing. It wasn't. And I thought, again, that was something really interesting. Like you say, you can't. And she described it to me was, you know, I'm just wired differently. I don't understand why I'm wired differently, but I'm wired differently. And I just think, and he's just making me think like him.
Have you read the Chris Van Tulliken book, Ultra Processed People? You should. It blew me away. It really did. If anyone's listening and you're interested in that, Ultra Processed People by Chris
Van Tulliken.
Have you read it? No.
No. One of my colleagues, sorry, I've talked over Stephen, you must go back to him. One of my colleagues, Oliver, he always used to start his weight loss consultations, whatever they were, with quotes from that.
Oh, and there's a bit in it which almost relates to exactly what you just said, which is there's a genetic predisposition to obesity as a condition. Or so he even changes it from obesity to overweight. You have overweight. So he refers it to having overweight as a condition. And the foods, the ultra processed foods and things like that actually effectively exacerbate that condition and make it much harder to lose the weight. So it's almost like people that have overweight as
Predisposition
a
almost.
condition are the deck stacked against them because the food environment out there makes it so hard to actually be healthy in some cases.
No, I completely agree with that. And that's part of the journey where you're doing that re-education piece along with that awareness piece, along with some of this stuff where, like you say, you've articulated as well, you look 20 years without being able to do this. How do you bring that all together? And I think that's just the start of where the private services can go. Some of the pharmacies, we're doing earwax removal, we're doing travel vaccines, I'm writing prescriptions for people who can't see their GP for potentially antibiotics, or the access to the healthcare within a community pharmacy, I think, is going to really change over the next 4 or 5 years. Supplementing, I think, again, as everyone comes out as prescribers, sort of supplementing where community pharmacy sits in that healthcare journey, both from an NHS and a private point of view. It does make me excited still. And I've been doing this, like I say, since 1998. Well, stacking shelves in my dad's shop since I was 12 and getting paid 45p an hour, which I thought was very generous.
Don't spend that all at once.
Oh.
So touching on like in the last couple of minutes of the show, I always like to kind of tap into the guests, sort of like their mottos or the words that they've used through difficult times, as I'm sure that you've had in all kinds of running all kinds of businesses in all kinds of different ways in a very difficult sector. So, and how do you and your colleagues and the people that you work with, like, how do you bind yourselves together on this mission?
Yeah, so I think that's a fascinating question. So I think it's not losing the sight of what we do. And the other thing that I sort of said to me as well, and I heard this from an All Black who I heard speak, was pressure is a privilege. So in a minute, when I've got to go into Portcullis House and I have to have some very difficult conversations, I remind myself that weight of responsibility, that pressure is a privilege. So there's some stuff I think which I like to articulate. My mum, who passed away when she was quite young, I'm now older than my mum ever was, but she used to say to me, one of your great strengths, Nick, is you can talk to a politician or someone that's come in from the rugby club in exactly the same way. So a uniformity of care, a uniformity of delivery, everyone gets special treatment, that level of care is the same. And some of the other bigger things I do is just reminding myself why we do it, and that pressure being a privilege, which sometimes hard.
Yeah, I can imagine. That reminds me, I heard something similar, which was, it's not I have to do this, it's I get to do this.
Yeah, well, somebody, one my vice chair, when we were doing a talk the other day, and he turned around to me and he said, "It's not what I do, it's why I do." So, why do I do a private service? Because there's a need. Why do I do a delivery for somebody with terminal cancer? Because I've got some pain relief to give them. It's the why, not the what. The what falls out from the why. That again, I think, is just hugely powerful. A lot of the why around community pharmacies is they care about the people that they're in the community with. They're all part and intertwined together.
And on an we have to stop in like 30 seconds, but that reminds me of one thing that I've heard more than I thought I ever would when I was in community pharmacy about people doing free deliveries. Right? People, pharmacists or people dropping off medicines for free without any expectation of payment whatsoever because that person needs the medicine.
I had an email from the nursing home at 9 o'clock on Thursday night and reopened the pharmacy to go back and drop off some antibiotics because someone had missed it.
Right, and that's the stuff that doesn't get seen, or
No,
yeah,
but that's not my question.
that's just what you do. So anyway, Nick, look, it was a wonderful show. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me on. I'm really pleased to have the opportunity to talk about some pharmacy, and thank you for all the stuff you do, Steve. It's great.
Brilliant, and good luck later in Portcullis House. We're rooting for you.
Thank you. I try my best.
And thanks to everyone for listening. We'll be back again next week with another show. Thanks a lot.